The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, friends. This is Larry Wilson for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Money Matters. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you articles of interest from Money.com, AARP Bulletin, and also AARP.com. Our first article from Money.com, this article is by Leslie Cook. Trump's 50-year mortgage idea is no silver bullet for housing affordability. Could 50-year mortgages be the key to unlocking cheaper houses? That's the debate among real estate experts after a Truth Postal post by President Donald Trump, who floated the idea to improve housing affordability, especially for first-time buyers struggling with elevated mortgage rates and high home prices. Most mortgages have 30-year terms. The goal of extending them by 20 years would be to lower monthly payments to a level accessible to more prospective homeowners and to help jumpstart the sluggish housing market. On the surface, the idea of a 50-year mortgage may sound promising, but experts say longer mortgages may pose a greater risk to buyers in the long run. While lower monthly payments on a longer-term loan could certainly decrease Americans' overall monthly expenses and free up cash for other costs, a 50-year mortgage is, quote, no silver bullet in terms of improving housing affordability, says Ken Sism, associate broker at Coldwell Banker Realty in California. The real impact of a 50-year mortgage on monthly payments. The main argument in favor of extending the repayment period is that it could lower people's monthly mortgage payments. Lower payments could make it easier for younger buyers to enter the market and benefit homeowners who could refinance. For example, a 30-year, $400,000 fixed-rate loan at 6.22%, Freddie Mac's current national average, has a monthly payment of $2,455, excluding taxes and insurance. The same loan over 50 years at the same rate would have a payment of $2,171. That's a savings of nearly $300 every month. However, those eye-popping numbers aren't likely to be real. Just as the interest rate on a 30-year mortgage is higher than that on a 15-year one, the rate on a 50-year mortgage is likely to be higher than that on a 30-year one. No one knows how much higher the rate will be, but assuming a difference of 0.70 percentage points, which is the current gap between a 30 and 15-year mortgage, the monthly savings provided by a half-century-long mortgage are reduced to $79. Even Trump has acknowledged that the savings from a 50-year mortgage might not be massive. Speaking on Fox News, on Monday, the president said, it's not like a big factor, adding that it might help a little bit. Without a clear idea of exactly how much lower payments could get, there's doubt about how many prospective buyers would even be able to take advantage of a longer term. Joel Berner, senior economist at Realtor.com, says he believes that borrowers who are currently on the margin of being approved for a loan could benefit the most. The hazards associated with such a long loan term, on the other hand, could affect a much larger group of borrowers. The downsides of a 50-year mortgage. Experts say there are also risks involved in relying on an extended repayment period alone to address the problems facing buyers in today's market. For example, a 50-year loan, according to Berner, doesn't address the lack of enough inventory to meet demand or help reduce home prices. In fact, Berner says he believes that if a large number of borrowers were to adopt this new loan term, the ensuing increase in demand actually could drive greater competition and send home prices higher. All it does is subsidize buyers, making it easier for them to chase after the same number of homes on the market, Berner says. That drives prices up, and all the savings go out the window. Another concern has to do with home ownership's role in building long-term wealth through home equity. An analysis by Realtor.com estimates that at the end of a 10-year term, a borrower with a 30-year mortgage would have paid down enough of the principal to accumulate a 24% equity stake in their home, enough to eliminate private mortgage insurance or to refinance the loan or apply for a home equity loan. With a 50-year loan, that would drop to just 14%, significantly limiting someone's refinancing options. By the same token, the increased interest rate and longer payback time mean a homeowner will end up paying a lot more interest over the full term of the loan. Some estimates even double the amount of total interest paid on a shorter loan. Homeowners could also find themselves scrambling if home values start to drop, because the principal on a 50-year loan would be paid off so slowly, a significant decrease in home values could leave the property underwater or owing more than it's actually worth. This would leave the owner with a very few options if they were to run into financial distress. In the end, while the idea of a 50-year mortgage may seem like a potential solution to America's housing affordability crisis, Sism notes that the word, quote, savings isn't quite the right one to associate with such a long-term loan. Rather, he says, the whole idea simply defers payment of the principal balance owed, and by doing so, costs significantly more in the way of interest paid. Our next article, using a blended income strategy can help boost your retirement cash flow. This article appeared in Money.com and is by Jordan Chesler. More Americans are expected to reach retirement age this year than ever before. For many folks hitting the milestone, a difficult reality may await. That's because fewer people are feeling secure with their plans. According to Fidelity Investments' 2025 State of Retirement Planning study, while two-thirds of people in their planning years feel confident with their prospects, that figure is 7 percent points lower than last year. Meanwhile, 70% of retirees say that rising living costs have eroded their savings. Fidelity's findings aren't the only indication of trying times ahead for retirees. A recent survey from the Senior Citizens League found that 31.8 million older Americans get by on less than $2,000 a month, and in a TIAA survey released last month, 44% of respondents said they expect Social Security to be their primary source of income in retirement. Being that dependent on Social Security benefits is a slippery slope towards financial hardship, one way to build confidence and avoid these troubles is with a comprehensive retirement plan, which can entail using your investments as part of a blended income strategy to help offset recurring and unexpected costs through your golden years. Well, what is blended income? Put simply, blended income means having several sources of money to draw from during retirement. The benefit is clear when looking at the average monthly Social Security benefit, which stood at about $2,000 for most of 2025. That considerably lags older Americans' monthly expenditures, which average $5,007 for those ages 65 to 74, according to Federal Reserve economic data. Creating a stream of blended income can help retirees fill that gap. Nearly 60% of retirees with a blended income strategy reported having a better lifestyle after retiring, compared with 49% of retirees who used only one additional income source aside from Social Security, according to a 2023 Goldman Sachs survey. Retirees using a blended income strategy also reported higher levels of satisfaction with their money. Blended income combines multiple sources of both fixed and variable income to create diversified, steady cash flow. Fixed income includes predetermined amounts from sources like annuities, bonds, pensions, and Social Security, while variable income comes from sources where your money can ebb and flow, such as traditional or Roth IRAs, employer-sponsored plans like 401ks, and taxable savings and investment accounts. Each type has its benefits and risk, according to a report from investment advisory firm Vanguard, which recommends using both regular, aka fixed, and variable sources to produce retirement income. While fixed income provides predictability and insulates you from market swings, it also precludes you from accessing the higher returns equities can deliver. Alternatively, variable income is more difficult to forecast, but provides a higher risk-reward ratio. Combining them allows you to reap the benefits of each while limiting the downsides. Before planning on how to diversify your retirement income, you first need to establish your risk tolerance. Finding that sweet spot is the first thing that we do with a client, says Jamie Ruff, certified financial planner and senior wealth advisor at HB Wealth. Then we can start thinking about the income construction. Understanding your risk tolerance can help you figure out how to best approach potential deficits between your expected retirement income and your likely expenses. We prepare a financial plan that considers all the sources of income that are not in their investments, like a pension or Social Security, or even a post-retirement gig, says Ruff. Then we work into a long-term projection where you deduct expenses, and there's this line, then, for what total return they need to meet their goals. Once that line is determined and you know what your total return is required, the next step is crafting a blended retirement income plan, is determining which sources of fixed and variable income will factor into the equation. And fixed retirement income. Before Social Security, fixed retirement income is often associated with annuities, bonds, and defined benefit plans like pensions. It can also include cash alternatives like certificates of deposits and nuanced financial instruments like mortgage-backed securities. Annuities, which have increased in popularity, are contracts issued by insurance companies that provide an income stream to the purchaser in exchange for premiums they have paid. Notably, these products are not the same as life insurance policies that only pay benefits when the insured dies. While there are both fixed and variable annuities, fixed annuities provide guaranteed returns for a term or the remainder of your life, and are not linked to market performance. Annuities can carry high costs, though. For one, you'll owe a premium, which can be paid as a lump sum or installments. On top of the premiums, the sum of commissions, expense ratios, and other fees can make annuities more costly than other investments. The commission for a 10-year annuity, for example, can range from 6% to 8%, compared to 0.5% to 2% for stocks and bonds. I like fixed income. I like guaranteed income, Ruff says. It's just the cost of getting an annuity is sometimes really high. He prefers bonds, noting that when they mature, you can decide to use the principal as income or reinvest it. This can be achieved through bond laddering. That's creating a timeline with multiple bonds carrying varying maturity dates, which allows you to either capture the proceeds as income or reinvest them to continue growing your money. Laddering is particularly appealing to those with lower risk tolerances. Ruff suggests treasuries for those looking for safety and guaranteed income, noting that they are theoretically the safest bond in the world since they're issued by the federal government. He also recommends corporate bonds, which have incredibly low default rates. Bonds are like the ballast in a ship. They help steady things, Ruff says. I like to see clients have several years' worth of cash and bonds available to meet their needs. So if the stock market drops a lot, they still have plenty of things in their portfolio that don't drop. Since the core concept of a blended income strategy is diversifying your sources, combining treasuries, corporate bonds, and even cash equivalents like CDs can provide numerous sources of fixed income to supplement Social Security. Variable retirement income. Variable retirement, it provides greater access to your funds than fixed income, but it carries less predictable yields. Traditionally, sources of variable income include investments made through a 401k, IRA, or brokerage account. However, it can also include income generated from alternative assets such as real estate. When considering how to invest for variable income, be mindful that equities such as stocks, mutual funds, and ETFs, whether in a tax-advantaged retirement account or normal brokerage account, carry higher risk. Once retired, you should focus on wealth preservation and income generation, not share appreciation, as older investors have less time to recover from losses. A lot of people put it all in stocks, Ruff says, and the risk is at some point the stock market is going to go down, and a lot of people will lose a lot of money when it does. That's why experts say it's prudent to focus on conservative holdings as opposed to growth stocks. This can be accomplished with a combination of income-producing equities, such as bond funds, which pay dividends unlike individual bonds that are tied up until they reach maturity, dividend ETFs, and stocks in sectors known for slower growth and lower volatility. Stocks with a reliable history of consistent or steadily increasing dividend payouts are likely to be the most attractive to consider for this purpose, according to a report from U.S. Bank. Still, equities carry an elevated risk-reward ratio, so you'll want to balance them with other income streams. Bank products such as high-yield savings accounts and money market accounts offer additional sources of variable income while providing a layer of safety. The APYs for those types of deposit accounts are not fixed, but they are typically protected by FDIC or NCUA insurance and provide better liquidity than fixed income alternatives like CDs. Once you quit your job, you no longer have employment income, Ruff says. So, you need to consider safety as part of your strategy. And we'll switch gears a little bit as we move to an article that appeared in the AARP Bulletin. This article by Lisa Lee Freeman. Discount Grocer Smackdown. Testing prices and products at Aldi's, Lidl, and Trader Joe's. My husband Bill and I used to shop weekly at the local supermarket. No more. Like many other people, we're now regulars at one of the discount grocery chains that sell a limited selection of mostly private label products. To find out how much you can save at these stores, Bill and I visited three big discounters, Aldi, Lidl, and Trader Joe's, and our nearby supermarket. Here's what we found. Number one, price. Aldi and Lidl were the hands-down winners. Their house brands often saved us 50% or more over national brands and 20% or more over supermarket label products. For example, the regular price of English muffins at Lidl was $1.49, compared with $5.29 for the supermarket's Thomas Original English muffins. That's a 72% savings, and $1.99 for its house brand. Although Trader Joe's beat national brands by about 40% on a basket of staples such as milk, cream cheese, butter, and whole wheat bread, many of the chain's prices were similar to those of supermarket house brands. Number two, taste. Blind test of six products had me sampling each store's house brand, plus a national brand. The takeaway? The cheaper house brand versions at Aldi, Lidl, and Trader Joe's may not taste like the brand names that you're used to. On the other hand, you might like them better. At a family gathering, we put out five unlabeled bowls of potato chips. Four of them got top scores from different relatives. My advice? Do your own taste test. All three discounters let you return what you don't like. Number three, selection. We saw more brand names at Aldi and Lidl than at Trader Joe's. Also, we enjoyed their infamous Anything Goes aisles, Aldi Finds, informally known as Aldi's Isle of Shame, and the Lidl Middle. They feature a mix of household goods, clothing, and seasonal items. At Trader Joe's, you won't find a giraffe-shaped pool noodle, $4.99 at Aldi, or a self-stirring coffee mug, $12.99 at Lidl, but you will discover plenty of unique grocery finds like Ubi tea cookies, purple yam shortbread cookies, which were yummy. Number four, vibe. We shop during busy weekend hours, and despite big crowds, checkout was fast and friendly at Trader Joe's, which feels a bit like a health food store. Aldi's looked like a mini supermarket with an efficient checkout area. But the Lidl store we visited was a bit disheveled, and we had to wait in a slow-moving line for the loan-only register. And the bottom line, if price is your priority, Aldi and Lidl are worth the trip. You can save even more by stocking up on their weekly specials. Trader Joe's may not be the cheapest, but it's a good value and carries a lot of unique products. At all three chains, the smaller format is a plus. It can save you time, unless, of course, you get sidelined by the Isle of Shame. And as we wrap up our episode today, this is a timely article appeared in the AARP.com section. 2025 IRS tax deadlines you can't afford to miss. Is tax day April 15th this year? When are estimated taxes due? Our federal filing calendar has the answers. This article by Daniel Bortez. As we look forward to 2025, we can mark significant dates on our calendars, birthdays, anniversaries, and of course the deadlines the IRS sets for filing and paying federal income taxes. Bear in mind that we are filing taxes for income earned during 2025, even though we filed the forms in 2026. To keep confusion to a minimum, tax experts refer to the tax year and not the filing year. Most, but not all, of the deadlines in 2026 refer to the tax year for 25. And don't blow the deadline. The penalty for late filing is 5% of the amount due each month, maxing out to 25% a year. Interest also accrues at a rate of 3% compounding daily. If you must file late, you can get an automatic extension by filing IRS Form 4868, and the automatic extension will give you until October 15th of that following year when you file your previous year's tax. Some taxpayers affected by recent national disasters get extra time to file. And let's see, here are a couple of estimated deadlines. Coming up January 15th, final estimated tax payments for 2025 due. January 27th, IRS begins processing the 2025 tax returns. April 15th, filing deadline for the taxes. First estimated tax payment for tax year of 2026 due. June 16th, second estimated tax payment for 2026 due. September 15th, third estimated tax payment for 2026 due. Let's see, October 15th, extended the line to file a 2025 tax return. The IRS will begin accepting and processing your returns January 27th. Agency says most taxpayers will get their refunds within 21 days of when they file electronically, barring any issues with processing their tax return. And let's see, a couple of quick things here as we wrap up. Great ways to save on insurance. With insurance rates on the rise, it is more important than ever to be a careful shopper. Here's how to get a deal without sacrificing coverage. Number one, shop around. Number two, highlight any home improvements you've made. Three, you can look at boosting your deductible to save money. Consider telematics as you look for different insurance options that require drivers to install a device on their car or download a smartphone app. Take advantage of life changes. Don't sweat the small stuff, and make sure you bundle up. Well, we now have run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. I'm Larry Wilson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's episode of Money Matters is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Money Matters is also available as podcast at ncreadingservice.org. Thanks again for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.